This is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT 89.5 FM. I think we are joined by Tony Leah. Are you there, Tony?
Hi, Phil.
Sorry, I took a while to cover all that. By the way, you saw that. I think you're one of the people who sent that to me. I got it from several quarters. But the story of Trump's conduct at this moment, this whole Apocalypse Now, Duval, crazy deportations, et cetera, is apparently, well, I guess it's giving some pause. We're seeing California starting to talk about becoming an independent country. But as it applies, actually, to American circles, this matter of his making a kind of a reactionary fetish about talking about foreigners and how he loves deportation. A big moment happened at an auto plant, and this is your specialty territory, in Georgia, where a plant, a Hyundai plant, was raided. So tell us about that, and is that plant, what are they making there, and what is the, do they have a future after this whole event? Talk about that, if you would.
Sure. There's two plants side by side. One plant, Hyundai, invested a couple of $1 billion with support from the government of Georgia to build an electric vehicle plant, and it went into operation about a year ago. It's operating at about 300,000 vehicles a year right now. So there's a couple of thousand workers assembling those vehicles right now. Beside that plant, Hyundai, in a joint venture with a battery maker, was building a new plant to manufacture electric batteries for electric vehicles. And as that construction site that was raided, it's another couple of $1 billion investment by Hyundai and the battery maker.
Hyundai,
and
I got to learn to say that. I've been saying Hyundai.
I think that's Hyundai.
Okay.
However you say it, that's what it is.
Do they have a cavalry? I have trouble with both words today.
I don't think they have a...
They don't have a cavalry. They have a cavalry.
I don't think they have a cavalry, no.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about a cavalry. LG, I think, is the joint venture partner. And again, it's an investment that's supported by the government of Georgia, with the potential for a couple of thousand jobs long term. So these are major investments. They are were certainly seen or promoted as advancing electric vehicle production in the United States, which is part of Donald Trump's stated program. And in order to get the plant constructed, a lot of this type of investment by offshore companies, they like to bring their own workers to do the construction and get things set up, whether legally or skirting the legal rules. And they've been able to do that or permitted to do that. And in the case of this plant in particular, and Hyundai as a corporation, the United Auto Workers claims that they abuse, at least some of those workers, some of them would be high-tech workers, but a lot of them would be normal.
Are we talking about their own? You mean those that they're bringing from South Korea?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And I don't know the details, and there's a lot of smoke to be cleared before we understand exactly what happened there. But 500, the ICE and Homeland Security moved in, and it was like a military operation because they moved in and arrested some 500 workers. And a large percentage of them are South Korean. They put them in chains and chained them together and marched them out of there.
chains.
In chains, yeah. I watched
This is a non-resisting individual who's just standing at his workplace, I gather.
Yeah, they're there building a plant, you know. Yeah. They're doing construction work, some of them. Some of them are doing engineers. Some of them are engineers. I don't know who all of them are. We don't know all of the details yet. But it was like a military operation. I would have expected, if you think somebody's violating visa rules, you know, you interview them and you lay charges if it's warranted or if you think it's warranted. But this was for show. Yes. This is to show military might and how you're exercising it. And I think that it's noteworthy that the United Auto Workers, UAW, issued a statement yesterday. Maybe I read some of it for your listeners.
Mm-hmm.
The UAW condemns Hyundai's disgraceful record on worker safety. For years, Hyundai, including its joint ventures and the suppliers that work in its plants, cut corners on the industry standard safety precautions, refused to respect workers' rights to a union, and relied on the exploitation of immigrant labor to build its factories and supply chains. We've recently seen the consequences of this behavior. Three workers at Hyundai were killed at work in the last 2 years. That's in the United States. Three workplace fatalities. When workers are put in danger by predatory companies like Hyundai, there is an opportunity for a constructive response from the federal government. OSHA and the NLRB have tools at their disposal to increase workplace safety. Unfortunately, the militarized federal crackdown on these workers further hurts safety at Hyundai. Workers are not the problem. Exploitative corporations are. The UAW will always stand with all workers, immigrant and native-born alike, against unsafe corporations and militarized attacks on our workplaces.
Uh-huh. Is that it? And that's it?
That's it. That's the full statement, actually, that the UAW issued yesterday.
It's better than I would have expected. But there's a big issue here. That plant, the part that they closed down must be closed down, right? Because
the construction, is absolutely shut down for the time being.
So, and what were they going to be doing there?
They were constructing a plant to manufacture electric batteries for vehicles.
Oh, what do you know? I mean, it seems like he's sending a big, heavy message about electric vehicles. But he's talking about foreign workers, but actually he just shut a plant down.
Shut down a construction.
Nobody can make it get up and go, because those were the workers that had the skills and whatever to make it go.
Yep. And with the support of the government of Georgia, and the governor of Georgia is also part of the target. Trump does not like him. Doesn't like electric vehicles, doesn't like any renewable energy resources. He just ordered a stop to a $7 billion project for wind power off the East Coast that was almost completed. It's all a rather shocking display of naked power for his political agenda.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Tony Leo about this dramatic blow struck at electric vehicle plant in a South Korean invested operation, and that's another element of it, right? I mean, the South Koreans, by the way, he's created a crisis inside South Korea because, and you tell me, isn't it true that the South Korean position is you asked us to invest in your country, we did it, and now you've attacked us. Isn't that the position?
Yes. And but they've had meetings, and the South Koreans say that they've negotiated and resolved, or partial resolve, which will allow them to send a plane to the United States to pick up these workers, get them out of detention, and take them back to South Korea. At the moment, they're all in a detention center in the United States.
Some of them could end up in a small country in Africa.
The way these things
it's
go,
a gulag system. You don't know where they're going to... They reserve the right to move anybody anywhere they want.
Yep.
But how can that be any kind of a... So, okay, so you take them out of the country, but what happens to the plant?
Well, that's the part that's not resolved at all.
And that's a lot of... But back to my point there, that was... They said, we've invested billions here.
Mm-hmm.
So do they get their money back? Or does the plant disappear? What happens?
That remains to be seen.
And isn't it true that the UAW, they must have made an attempt to organize those people?
The UAW, under the new leadership that was elected by one member, one vote, a couple of years ago, has made a determined effort to organize the unorganized plants by... operated by Toyota and Honda and Hyundai and Volkswagen, a number of others in the United States, and made one breakthrough in Tennessee at the Volkswagen plant in Chattanooga. So the plant that's operating in Georgia, I'm sure, was one of the ones that they had targeted, but they haven't been successful at any others yet. They have organized a couple of other electric vehicle battery plants in the United States, but no success at the Georgia plant that I'm aware of.
It's a good chance to underline something we've talked to you about previous on this show, but it ought to be emphasized. Is that the American labor movement, is many of the leaders harp a lot about, that work has gone abroad and we're competing against low-wage countries, and that's not fair. We got to do something about those countries. But the low-wage country that seems to get an awful lot of work and a transfer of new industry where there's no union seems to be a country called the American South.
Yes.
I don't know. Do you speak the language or know anything about what's going on there? Maybe that's why we're saving our Confederate money.
It's a pretty strange country indeed. It's true that for decades now, that it's been a strategy of the auto manufacturing companies to try to escape unionized environments by setting up new plants, particularly in the U.S. South, in the places like Georgia and Tennessee and so on.
It's really
Alabama.
Been a rock against unions.
And it really has, and they've been able to operate very profitably for quite a while now in those locations without unions and lower wages and obviously unsafe working conditions, as this particular episode highlights.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also had the effect of dramatically dividing, weakening the labor movement in the United States, because you have more and more, the balance has shifted, really. The balance has shifted from unionized plants in the industry to non-unionized. They now set the standard and are the bulk of the production. And, it has really weakened workers in the United States, this division.
Mm-hmm. Well, on this... Continuing this matter of what's happening with the all talk of saving the environment, clean air, and less expensive vehicles with electric power, The Canadian government has decided that they're going to waive the mandate, which they had set for 2026. Curiously, the industry says it has to go further. Could you explain what is going on there?
As part of a long-term plan towards reducing emission of greenhouse gases, and a big part of that, of the Canadian plan to do that, involved phasing out internal combustion engine vehicles. And the next step in their announced plan from a number of years ago was that by 2026, auto companies had to sell 20% of the vehicles they sell in Canada needed to be electric or or not gas-powered vehicles anyway. And it was the manufacturing companies that went to the government and said, we cannot meet that standard for 2026. You need to get rid of it. So it was pressure from the companies that caused the Carney government to backtrack and agree to what they were being demanded, that they remove that mandate. So they have done that. And the auto company said, well, that's good, but you need to do more. Get rid of it, not just for next year, but all of it. Trash the whole thing.
So they're committed to the fossil fuel strategy of Donald Trump.
Yes. And what the North American producers, when I say North American, I mean American companies, Ford and General Motors, have found is that there's more profit in large gas-guzzling pickup trucks and SUVs. Mm-hmm. And there's not as much profit in small, affordable consumer vehicles. So, of course, they want to build the ones where they get the most profit. Mm-hmm. Pickup trucks, GM, makes a net profit of somewhere around $20,000 per vehicle. That's profit per vehicle. So they would rather do that than anything else. And as you may have noticed, they don't build a vehicle, not in North America, that most of us can afford to drive, or most workers certainly cannot afford to drive. Mm-hmm. And then they want to put barriers up so that nobody else can come in and sell those cheaper vehicles either.
100%
Tariff.
Yes.
For example, this is an example. And, you know, the net result of that is a very distorted industry. But it's fundamental to understanding why it works like that is because we allow corporations to make the decisions based on what's best for them, how they can maximize their profits. It's not what's best for workers, or certainly not best for our communities, not best for Canada to be playing along with this, but we do, and that's what our government has done. They take their marching orders from General Motors, Ford, to some extent Toyota and Honda, who have plants in Canada, Stellantis, which is not an American company anymore. It used to be Chrysler, U.S. company, but it's now Stellantis, headquartered in the Netherlands, and it's a French and Italian company, basically. They call the shots. Mm-hmm. And our government takes no steps which would reduce their power to make the decisions.
Yeah, they seem to be directing their elbows at the working class, actually. That's smack.
Yes, that's who gets it.
Our elbows are strictly for you. That isn't, of course, how they ran for office. They told us they wanted clean air and inexpensive vehicles, and EV was the future, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Just to be real, I mean, you've pointed out in the show previous, there are countries, I think Norway is in the front, who are actually serious about EV, and they've got it. They're on their way to 80%, 100%.
Well, yeah, they're currently, I think that it's almost 100% of vehicles sold in Norway are electric. There are other countries that have used government policy to achieve that goal. And, of course, foremost of them all is China, which far outproduces all the rest of the world in electric vehicles.
Which also puts them ahead in clean air and in reduction of carbon.
Yes, and they are outperforming every other country in establishing renewable energy, wind and solar power, and hydropower, and transforming their industries and transforming their cities, and using government ownership or government levers of power to
yes.
achieve the goals that they set. And if there's one thing we can say about China is when they set a goal, you can bet money that they're going to achieve that goal, and usually ahead of schedule. And that's what they've been showing. And they combine, not just building electric vehicles, but integrating that into a system in which there is much better public transportation, particularly rail and high-speed rail, which they have constructed some 45,000 kilometers of in the last 15 years. And while in the United States, I think that they are struggling to build the first kilometer over that period of time, despite investing quite a few billion dollars.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've increased the talk about it. I think we're talking about it 40% more than we used to talk about it.
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
We're really on the move in terms of discussing, but nothing happens. We have to discuss sometime this whole idea of basic sectors of the economy that ought to be under control of a government ruling on behalf of the people, right? Sometimes it gets into we have to own it. Well, if the workers, that would be 90% of the population, owned the government, they wouldn't have to worry about owning the company because they would tell the company what it could do and what it can't do.
Yes, but I think that it is true that if we wanted to make major progress, we should see major sectors of our economy under government ownership and or control, and then particularly transportation, energy.
Yes.
A lot of the problems that we're experiencing in transportation, in rail and air, for example, relate to that, the attacks on workers in those sectors. Relates to the fact that we've given ownership of them. A lot of that was government-owned.
Yes.
It was given away to corporations.
No, you could put the photograph of Pierre Trudeau alongside the maple leaf on the service station.
Mm-hmm.
That was the policy.
Yep.
He had that notion, and they eventually laughed him off the stage. But he was following along the way the Mexico thinks. Mexico took care of Standard Oil. They said it's now belongs to Mexico.
Yep.
Almost caused a war. I mean, the wonderful liberal Franklin Roosevelt was tempted, but decided it wasn't a good idea to try to prevent Mexico from exercising its sovereignty over the energy sector. We're speaking to Tony Leo, by the way, the author of a great book, The Truth About the GM Oshawa Strike of 1937. I get my syntax wrong there, but if it's syntax. I got it roughly accurate, I think, didn't I?
Yes.
Go to Baraka Books and get a copy. That brings us, we got to talk about the big one. The flight attendants now have said, well, we don't want this contract, and it's 99%, but they seem to be locked into something here. Can you tell us what kind of dilemma we have with the and the role of the Canadian government on behalf of all of us, where we have they vote 100%, almost 100% against, but there's no strike.
I think that there is a lot of misunderstanding about the situation because it is a bit complex.
Putting it mildly, thank you.
So let me try to unravel it a little bit. The flight attendants, some 10,000 of them, who work for Air Canada and have been bargaining for a long time to try to achieve a collective agreement that compensated them fairly, highlighted in particular the issue of unpaid work because they get paid for hours when they're actually in the air. So the hourly rate that's negotiated in their collective agreement only applies to the hours when they're actually in the air. But they were required to work, of course, before the plane takes off and after it lands. Mm-hmm. And so those were unpaid hours. Mm-hmm. And they highlighted that very unfair issue and garnered a lot of public support for it and really put pressure on the government, but achieved absolutely nothing in negotiations. And the reason that the employer, Air Canada, which is now a privatized company operated for profit, which has been making very hefty profits since they've recovered from the pandemic shutdowns and could afford, presumably, to compensate workers for all of the hours they work, you know, maybe, like our labor code on the face of it provides, didn't bargain, weren't willing to bargain. And they revealed, maybe inadvertently, why they didn't bargain seriously, because they knew that the government would step in if there was a strike or lockout. Mm-hmm. And when there was a strike deadline, even before the deadline, management started canceling flights. And that caused the government to act.
Yes, an artificial crisis.
They created the crisis. And they, the government almost immediately, once the workers then did go on strike, ordered the Canada Industrial Relations Board, CIRB, through a reference to Section 107 of the Canada Labor Code to intervene.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is something that was a little-known section of the Canada's Labor Act. It's been in existence for only about 40 years, a little bit less than 40 years. But hasn't been used before.
Catch 22.
Yes, until about a year ago, 2024.
Mm-hmm.
Other governments have intervened in worker strikes, but they've done it through passing legislation, which means it has to be debated in Parliament, and people get to examine it and question it and argue about it, and the public can weigh in what they think. But with Section 107, it's only the Minister of Labor who can order the board to take action. And they discovered that they could use this against the postal workers in 2024. They used it against
dock workers, right?
Dock workers, the ILWU and QP workers at ports in Montreal, Quebec City, and Vancouver. They used it against workers at CN Rail and CP Rail. They were poised to use it against workers at WestJet. And then they used it against the postal workers, all in 2024, seven occasions. They were way crazy. They said, oh, well, look, we've got a weapon we can use here that is foolproof. We just issue the order. It doesn't have to be debated or voted on or anything. And they were getting away with it. And so they used it again against the flight attendants at Air Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And they discovered a problem that these orders don't work if the workers don't work.
Yeah.
Yes. And wow, the flight attendants, and thanks to, I think, some preparation and organization and solidarity, said, no, you can issue that order. We're not going back to work. We're still on strike. And their leadership, to their credit, said, Buddha's in jail. But we're
that's
not.
A big moment. And by the way, people are arguing that this particular Catch-22 thing may go down over this, that it's not going to be easy the next time to just to use it.
QP and the flight attendants have shown other workers an effective strategy if the government tries to use it against somebody in the future. That's true. That they have shown that there's a way to beat it. Mm-hmm. And once they announce their refusal to return to work and their willingness to stand up to legislation and even have the leaders announce their willingness to go to jail if that's what it required, at that point, I'm sure that there was some discussion with the government. There were certainly discussions with the management of Air Canada, and they got back to negotiating the same day. Mm-hmm. And as a result, there were no legal actions taken against the workers who were on strike or their union. Mm-hmm. Or any further legal proceedings, because an agreement was negotiated. And but that agreement was still negotiated within the legal restrictive structure of the order to refer the issues to binding arbitration. So the union was not successful in getting the government to withdraw the Section 107 reference. And so what they did was they negotiated an agreement on the major issues in dispute, including wages and including the issue of unpaid work, but did not remove the strike ban. And they agreed in that agreement that workers would have the right to vote only on the wage portion of the agreement. And if they rejected it, that the wages would go to binding arbitration.
Binding.
Mm-hmm. And that the rest of the agreement would stay in place.
Yeah. But I want to read something here from today's Globe and Mail. The QP spokesperson, he said, Air Canada never bargained in good faith on wages, Wesley Levosky, president of the Air Canada component of QP, said in a statement by CEO Michael Rousseau's own admission, the company expected the federal government to intervene and take away the only leverage we had, our right to strike. Pretty clear.
That's exactly right. The CEO admitted that they didn't think they had to bargain, that the government would use Section 107 and that would be it.
It comes back to whose government is it? And it turns out it's the company's government.
It is the company's government. It's not our government. That's, I think, very clear.
Yeah.
So what happened was that this contract has been agreed to. In terms of the overall contract, the workers did not get to vote on it, and I think that's a shortcoming. So they achieved a tremendous amount. They achieved some significant movement on the issue of unpaid work, but not a complete victory.
Mm-hmm.
The contract provides that they'll be paid 50% for those hours.
Mm-hmm.
And that over the 4 years of the contract, that will increase to 70%. Mm-hmm. So that's not 100%, but it's a significant.
They did achieve a lot.
But they didn't get to vote on that. Mm-hmm. They did get to vote on the wage portion, and that was kind of a no-lose proposition for them, because if they voted yes, they would get the wages that were negotiated. And if they voted no, then it would go to a mediator and then an arbitrator, where they might get more. And so that explains the 99% vote against. They weren't urged by their union to vote yes, and it only made sense to vote no. And they, I guess, are smart enough to know that, and that's what they've done.
Yes.
So we'll see where that ends up.
Yeah, and we'll see what happens to 107 in the next go-round, the next time a major union takes on a company.
Yes.
Tony Leo, it's wonderful we could talk to you about this. There's a bunch of other matters we need to go into about all of them. So we look forward to talking to you again.
Thanks, Phil.
Tony Leo, Unifor activist and author of The Truth About the 37 GM Oshawa Strike. I think I got it all in one mouthful. Steve Fruitman's going to be coming up in fairly short order at 33:45-78, I want to tell everybody that next week we're going to be talking with Phil Conlon. He's going to be reviewing a book, a brand new book from Cormorant Press, and of course we'll come back to why Canada should change its posture towards China, Russia, Europe, everybody else. Let's call it a simple matter of an independent foreign policy that truly is an independent foreign policy for Canada. Pedro, thank you very much. This is the Taylor Report. See you next week.